The Anton Savage Show with Kearies.ie on News Talk.
And we'll be looking at all of the news making the papers, including the first appearance of Simon Harris as leader of Fine Gael, because he was giving the big speech at the Ardéis yesterday in Galway and seems to be coming in with something of a new broom, although the broom seems to be towing a lot of Enda Kenny's people with it, and we'll find out about that because Enda Kenny strangely made an appearance, albeit not in person, at the Ardéis yesterday. And there are some interesting promises around what Simon Harris thinks he's going to deliver, including 250,000 new homes in 5 years. So we'll find out how exactly he's intending to do that. Plus a whole lot more. As I said, Paddy Cosgrave is back in his previous position as the head of the Web Summit. And there's more. I don't know if you saw a couple of days ago, though. There was a report that Niagara, the region in Canada and Northern America, that the Niagara town had declared a state of emergency, not because of something that was happening, but because of something that would happen. So they declared a preemptive state of emergency. And the reason that they believed that it was necessary to declare a preemptive state of emergency was because they thought hordes were going to descend on the town, specifically possibly up to 1 million people might descend on the town. And that would put them in a huge challenge when it came to being able to feed, house and all of the rest of it for all those people. Why do all these people have a sudden urge to go to see Niagara Falls all of a sudden? Well, weirdly, they don't have an urge to go to see Niagara Falls. They have an urge to go to stand in Niagara Falls and look up, because that's going to be one of the best places to look at the solar eclipse that is due tomorrow. Or so I'm told, but I have no expertise in this area. Luckily, we have with us David Moore, who is editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine, who kind of knows a bit about this stuff. David, how much have I got accurate so far?
You're bang on the button there. Yep, the first one of the most picturesque photographs could be a total eclipse of the sun over Niagara Falls. They'll be praying for clear skies tomorrow.
Do we have any sense of whether or not they're likely to get it? Have you seen a weather forecast for Niagara Falls?
Weather forecasts are very difficult, and this is cloud cover, which is the most difficult part of difficult weather forecasts. So my advice to people trying to watch eclipses is always just, if it's happening overhead, just go out and look, even if the forecast is for a storm. I do remember an eclipse probably 10 years ago, and there was a storm like Kathleen forecast for Ireland, and no one was expected to see anything. Yet we got reports published in Astronomy Ireland magazine of people who got a break at Clonmel for just a few minutes, enough to see and take a few quick pictures of the eclipse. So weather forecasts, I'm afraid, they're not as accurate as, say, the movement of the celestial bodies, which we can predict to second accuracy. So we know for a fact the eclipse is going to happen, but if it's going to be a cloud over your head, that's another story.
Well, give us the facts then. What time is it going to happen over Ireland?
Yeah, well, there's two things. What they're going to get in Niagara is a total eclipse of the sun. And in fact, there's a thin strip from Mexico across Texas right the way up to Niagara Falls and into eastern Canada, where you will see a total eclipse of the sun. The most spectacular sight in nature. Day turns to night. The stars come out. The animals go sleep in the fields. Birds stop chirping. And it is an incredible thing to witness. I've seen two myself, one from Turkey, one from the USA 7 years ago in 2017. But there hasn't been one of those, a total eclipse of the sun, on Irish soil since 1724. Coincidentally, 400 years ago this year. And there won't be one on Irish soil again till 2090. But there will be partial eclipses. That's where a part of the sun gets covered by the moon. Not a spectacular day, doesn't turn to night, but you can see a bite taken out of the sun, and that's what we're going to get tomorrow, Monday, at about 5 to 8 in the evening, just as the sun is setting. And depends where you are. If you're on the east coast, the sun will set earlier than if you're on the west coast, so you'll see more from the west. But then again, those clouds we were talking about, they're actually going to be more important.
Now, David, I'm at this point, I no longer trust my memory about pretty much anything, but I have a recollection around 2001, 2002 of a relatively significant eclipse. I remember it going partially dark, or have I made that up?
No, you're probably thinking of August 1999. When we had a total eclipse that just missed the south coast of Ireland. There were actually flights that flew out over the Atlantic just to pick up the total eclipse. And of course, you've got the advantage of height there, so you're above the clouds as well. And there were ferries going between Ireland and France that also saw the eclipse. Cornwall in Britain actually got the total eclipse, so they had a total eclipse 1999, but officially Ireland didn't. But yeah, it did get cold. We were in the Phoenix Park at the time running a big event, and I remember starting off August nice and warm in a T-shirt and having to put on a coat during the middle of the eclipse. 92%, I think, of the sun was covered that time. And that will actually be repeated in August of 2026, when there'll be an eclipse that just, again, misses Ireland and heads down to Spain. So we're planning to actually have a special eclipse trip to Spain to see the total part, because it won't be difficult to get to on that occasion. But there'll be another partial eclipse next year from Ireland, and a very deep partial in 2026 for the one that goes over Spain. So partial eclipses, you usually get them every year or two on average. But, you know, they can come along one every year and then none. I think we had none for 10 years, one particular period in recent memory.
Well, tell you what, stick us in the diary for August 2026. And if I remain unfired through that period, we'll have you on the show from Spain and you can tell us what it's actually like. Before I let you go back to the thing you said earlier on, David. You said the birds stop singing and the animals decide to go to sleep. Is that the case? Does it actually fool nature into believing that it's nighttime?
Yes, it does, actually. And it's been well known, eclipses have been watched for millennia, that this is what happens. You know, they don't have clocks like we do. So if it happens in the middle of the day, they don't seem to figure out that there's not really time for the sun to have set yet. They just go by the ambient light. And in fact, you know, I don't think we'll notice any big effect even on the west coast of Ireland, with about 50% of the sun being covered. But people should keep an eye on what does happen. Does it get noticeably dark if you have clear skies? And whatever people do, we want them to send a report in to Astronomy Ireland magazine. We record all these eclipses. There are records in the National Library of the 1724 eclipse and what was seen from Ireland, and our magazine's filed there. So all of the partial eclipses we've had since then are recorded in the National Library that way. So if you just go to our website, astronomy.ie, you'll see the eclipse page we have up there and the email address to send your report. Even if you go out or you stand there in the rain for a half an hour, just tell us where you were, what you did or didn't see, and we'll include you in the report we'll be doing.
I almost asked the world's dumbest question, which is which direction should they look? The short answer being towards the sun. But remind us, what time tomorrow night is this due to happen?
Right, it kicks off almost at exactly the same time, within a minute, all over the island. So whether you're north, south, east or west, 7:55 is the time to remember. Get out a few minutes early just to be sure. Try and find somewhere that has a really clear western horizon. So up a hill if you can, or a large park perhaps. Phoenix Park would probably be good if you're looking west. Across places like the 15 acres will be a good spot. And if you're inland, maybe across a big lake, or if you're on the west, across the sea.
David, thank you very much. There you go. You can set the clocks for 7:53. That gives you a 2-minute window to get up the hill or up to the attic or wherever you're going to look out. That was David Moore, who is the editor of Astronomy Ireland magazine. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents if you'd like to get in touch with the show, or 087 1400 106. In a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by our panel to look at the Ireland Thinks poll, which is interesting in respect of whether or not there has been a bounce for Fine Gael in the popularity stakes as a function of the new leader coming in. Also, the University of Limerick, €100 million worth of funding apparently now in jeopardy, according to the Business Post, because of questions over the due diligence around house purchases. We'll be back after this break. I'm joined by Kevin Doyle, who is Group Head of News at Media House, otherwise known as the independent group, what own all of the independent publications and newspapers and the Belfast Telegraph and a load of other ones as well. Niamh Harrigan, who is sociologist and Labour Party candidate in the European elections in Ireland South, and John Cunningham, relationship director with Morgan McKinley. And there is much to talk about. Where we might start, Niamh, is with a story that relates to your alma mater, if one can use that term, when you were working there as opposed to just qualifying there.
Still working there, right. I work for Mary. I don't work for UL, so just to
but you are connected to
we
the
are
University
connected to
of
UL
Limerick.
Indeed, yes, we are.
So the story on the front page of the Business Post says, University of Limerick scandal puts €100 million funding in jeopardy. This is a story that has been bubbling along for some time, which is the apparent overspend on a number of properties that UL bought. And there are now questions about the corporate governance in respect of that and the due diligence was done. First of all, what was your reaction to the story overall?
Well, I suppose, as you say, Anton, it's been bubbling a long time. There has been a change at the senior leadership level since, the origins of this story. I think it's unfortunate to see it playing out the way it's done. It seems to be a very toxic situation. Certainly, I mean, in the nature of my work, so I'm the registrar, I'm RAI. I engage a lot with colleagues in UL. We have very positive relationships with the University of Limerick. This is an enormously stressful time for those people. It's an enormously stressful time for the college community. And I suppose the one piece I would add, and it, in some ways it mirrors the RTE story, in that often when there's a focus on like top line spending at the top level, there's much less attention at the lower levels, where people are often earning very, very small sums of money and really struggling to survive. And often the fear is that in the reform processes that come after that, and again, we're seeing some of this sort of playing out in RTE, that it's actually those people who experience the sharp end of it. And I suppose that would be a concern I have, because, you know, there is a lot, and certainly during my time in academia, the number of poorly paid or precarious staff in the sector has increased dramatically.
And there seems to be a direct impact on the service provision of the university, because what the Business Post is reporting is we knew that there was a concern. We now see that the HEA has been investigating and there is a report to emerge. But they have suspended capital investment in the veterinary school, which was due to get, I think, about 60 million euro. That has a direct impact on the provision.
Yeah, I don't actually know if that's been awarded yet. So there was three universities in the competition for the veterinary school. My understanding is there's very significant differences between what people think that's going to cost anyway. So, you know, who knows where that, you know, we have a massive shortage of vets at the moment. We're essentially sending people out to Poland to qualify as vets, and a lot of our current vets are Polish trained. So, I mean, that has to be dealt with. It is undoubtedly going to have an impact on the University of Limerick. And I think that's unfortunate. Again, my own son is attending the University of Limerick. And, you know, like many higher education institutions, they're stretched at the moment in terms of resources. And
you use the comparator of the RTE story, which began in a similar way around one single thing and then ballooned from there. Do you expect this to follow the same route?
I don't know, Anton. I really don't know. It depends on the journey it takes. It depends on the kind of choices people make, both in the HEA, both at government level, and both within the University of Limerick. And we're seeing that play out in RTE as well. You know what I mean? So it could go a number of different directions.
But also, you mentioned RTE. Any institutions that's depending on state funding needs to understand the three most important things are going to be governance, governance and governance. And the bottom line is, from UL's perspective, you just hope the due process will take place very quickly. They get it sorted and they get back, because the impact it's going to have on the university community is just appalling. But any institution that's getting any sort of funding from the government, they just have to be doubling down and getting these things right, because it's just not acceptable.
Let us move on to the big political stories of the weekend. And I should say again, John Cunningham, who is was just speaking there, who is Relationship Director with Morgan McKinley. Niamh Harrigan, socialist.
Well, sociologist. I can declare her to be a socialist. Made very often over the years, Anton. Yeah.
And Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at the Independent Group Media House. Kevin, last night saw Simon Harris take to the stage in his first sort of formal role as leader of Fine Gael to give his speech. What was your take?
My take was, it was kind of what I expected, in the sense that the theme of the whole evening, for those who don't sit down and watch political speeches at 6:30 on a sunny Friday or Saturday, a new energy. And I think he has, and the people around him, have gone to huge lengths to try and distance themselves from Leo Varadkar, while also saying Leo Varadkar was a great fella. And it's quite a kind of chameleon trick that Fine Gael are trying to do now, which is to say that we are new, we are shiny, we are buzzing. And there was a real, you read Philip Ryan's piece in the Zindo today about Showbiz Simon. And it's kind of, you know, almost like he had gone to some festival rather than to a party political gathering where they debate things like immigration and housing. So there is this idea that Simon is going to bring this new kind of appeal to the average man, to young people, to farmers, to everyone, basically. And that's what the speech was aimed at, was everybody. So It wasn't exactly going back to Fine Gael's core vote. I think it was almost a catch-all speech that was promising something for everyone in the House.
Well, we'll get into the details of the sort of the policy proposals and promises. I think promise might be a better term than proposal, because there is a lot of detail to be worked out in some of them. But before that, the thing that you mentioned about the New Dawn hearkening back to previous things, what did you make, John, of the very evident presence of Kate O'Connell, of Phil Hogan and of Enda Kenny?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, talking to people who are at it, there's two things that came across. One, Jennifer Carol McNeill and Hildegard Nocton gave two barnstorming speeches and got the place kind of buzzing, right? Another talk was then, of course, the return of the smiley head on Kate O'Connell and Phil Hogan wandering around like King Farouk, all right? Now, we all know Phil Hogan's probably one of the greatest electoral analysts in the country, and he's clearly back in from the cold. And again, when you think about the day that was in it, so Leo rides with his arm in a sling, he slips in quietly, stands down the back, and he's there in the room as his old world is sort of, you know, is kind of, you know, unravelling around him, okay?
It had a real feel of, you know, that awkward family Christmas thing where everybody, all the aunts and uncles and all the cousins have to come together, and it's like, you know, Mary and John haven't really spoken since we were here last year. I'm just imagining like Phil Hogan over here in one corner of the auditorium, and then Leo and his gang, and then Kate comes in and it's like, oh, there's your one. And it, like, you know, they're putting
but
on the happy family.
But attempt to cause that. I mean, the presence of Kate O'Connell and the press conferences with Kate O'Connell, who of course had the falling out of the previous regime, and the presence of particularly Enda Kenny, where
she said it was the end of a dark period in her life. Which was quite a dramatic statement, Anton. And in a sense, it was the, I suppose, shade not shade element of the way in which.
But it also demonstrated she is an extraordinary political person, and she used the trip to Galway in an extraordinary way to get in front of the camera and to start kind of getting herself reacquainted. But to me, it's that sense of the dysfunctional family all coming together. And to me, what Simon Harris is doing more than anything else, and he appears to have achieved it, is he's created a buzz and an energy about the party that gives them, I think, a sense of confidence going into the local and the European elections for start, all right? And, you know, I think that there's all the talk in the papers today about, is it just the headlines, okay? We'll wait and see, because to me, what's going to be fascinating is Tuesday and the cabinet appointment, and see what's going to happen.
Well, let's see some of what he had to say, because as I say, a lot of promises were made, prime amongst them promises relating to housing.
We will build 250,000 homes together over the next 5 years. We'll build more starter homes for our young people to buy. The waiver on development levies is working. It's making it cheaper to build and cheaper to buy, and I want to work with colleagues in government to see if it can now be extended.
Kevin Doyle, how exactly are Fine Gael going to build 250,000 houses? We're running at, what, about 28,000, 30,000?
In 2022, they built less than 30,000 houses. In 2019, they built less than 22,000 houses. Neither Rebuilding Ireland or Housing for All has, in any one year, met its estimated housing targets. For me, Anton, the disappointing part of it was that if you look at the, and I suppose this is really the issue with the whole Harris approach, it's how you diagnose the problem. If the problem was the personality, if the problem was Leo Varadkar, then they solved the problem, okay? But if the problem is actually the policy, there was no indication in what came through yesterday of how the policy. So, for instance, tucked way back in the papers today is a report about a central bank report that says institutional investors are more likely to raise rents. This is proved over a 10-year period. It's a 4.1% margin that they're more likely to. So we know institutional investors are a problem. They're a significant distorting factor in the property market.
But
you can build all the houses you want, Anton, but if somebody goes in the morning and buys them all and then rents them out, what does that solve? It solves nothing.
I suggest to you, if you hearken back to ancient Rome and ancient Greece, there was a job of a lad who, when things got bad, he would fling the flag into the opposing forces and everybody would say, fight your way together.
Yeah.
Is this not the same grand symbolic gesture that will ultimately achieve great things?
But how long will it last? Fionnuala Sheehan resurrects a great quote from Joe Higgins when he was describing Bertie Ahern. He said, asking Bertie Ahern was like playing handball against a haystack. And I suppose this is the Simon Harris approach. And the question is, will anybody be able to pin him down long enough to actually ask him any of the hard questions?
Well, Kevin Doyle, you have
yesterday
a horde of journalists
that
who will be tasked with exactly this job.
Yeah.
Was there any indication of where this 250 is coming from over 5 years? Because it's a huge increase, nearly doubling the targets.
Yeah, no, and I've seen this done in Ardèche speeches Well, almost every year, if we're honest, they come out, they have to say something that grabs you a headline on the front of the Sunday Independent or the Sunday Times. So they reach for something, and a big figure is always one of those things that'll get you a headline. I was really surprised that he went for 250, because Niamh quoted the figures last year, they got 32,500 homes. So you need 50,000 homes a year. Like, that is huge growth in house building, which I think we want. I think we want. But if you're going to get to 50 in that time frame, it's a very, it's one of those ones.
What about planning? What about the people to build?
Yes, it's one of those things that I feel he's already now put himself on a hook for.
Yeah.
And that we're going to be coming back, whatever happens with an election in 12 months' time, we're going to be coming back to Simon Harris at the next election going, well, that was rubbish if he's back in
government. But surely, Kevin, if he is in a position to be asked that question,
yeah,
he's a happy man and he has 5 years to deal with
That is a good argument, I suppose. And let's see what Sinn Féin and others promise at the election, because they may go beyond, I think the Labour Party have promised more, I'm right.
Yeah.
So they obviously think it is possible, even if I'm sitting here going, I don't think it's possible based on where we are at this moment.
But I think it's about the roadmap of how you do it. So, for instance, if in the morning, like if you look at apprentices in Ireland at the moment, they're not even paid the minimum wage. They do a lot of work in construction. Mm. If you actually had a tangible roadmap of say, okay, we need a really quick fix. We've done, like if you look at the late 60s in Ireland, we built an astonishing amount of housing in about 3 years. It can be done. But how do you do it within our current institutional framework? We saw no detail on that yesterday.
And I wonder what conversation you had with either Micheál Martin or Eamon Ryan with regard to that commitment on behalf of the government, all right? So I think that it really felt like it was a flag flyer. It actually felt unnecessary. It kind of strikes me that the weekend was nearly enough with regard to the energy piece and the people smiling in the back and coming together and people kind of getting interested in what's happening. But he's done it now. And I suppose all we can say is, I mean, the great benefit he has now is we're now talking about April 2024. There'll be an election by February, so there won't even be a full year to even check and see if they've achieved it, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, they may not even, like, if you look at the European elections, obviously, coming up, like, if a significant number of TDs, you know, end up in Europe, then you're going to have a whole slew of by-elections coming down the track.
It's in some ways, depending on what happens in June, we'll decide when the election is.
Yeah.
And I know Simon Harris has said it again over
Just
the weekend.
That, Kevin. June will decide why.
Well, with the local and European elections, we will get a flavour of who's going to be in our local councils. And that is the building block for who's going to be on the ticket for
the election.
The elections for the Dáil. But the other question is, there is a number of TDs, say Barry Cowan, for example, in Midlands Northwest, just to pick one, who I would think has a very good chance of winning a seat back there for Fianna Fáil that they don't currently have. Barry Cowan goes, that's an empty seat. There has to be a by-election within 6 months. If there's one or two more or someone falls off the grid in terms of a TD, do we get past the 6 months, hold by-elections 2 or 3 months out from election? Not likely.
Yeah, very messy.
So you end up with an election in November or December.
Just to bring you some of the text, Phil Hogan, Kate O'Connell, new brooms? More like same old, nothing will change. Can anyone save us from political rally type politics? Phil Hogan, enough said, Fine Gael are in free fall. Another, Simon Harris, while he was Minister for Health, made promises he did not fulfil, so why should we believe him now? And guys, let us not forget the accommodation crisis is real. I think we can all agree on that. Well, that brings us to the Sunday Independent today, which has done one of its Ireland Thinks polls, breaking down the significant issues that the nation is concerned about. And sort of unsurprisingly, John, prime amongst them is housing. Which of the following issues should be the two most important priorities to deal with? Housing and healthcare right up the top.
But no surprise, Anton, and in fairness, those are the issues that have been topping these polls for the last year. So in that sense, it hasn't told us anything that we don't really know. I suppose the interesting thing for me, looking at Harris yesterday, is the actual, you know, there's been a lot made of Harris being the youngest Taoiseach and how great that is. But he is actually in that generation. I think you could say maybe my generation is the last generation. My husband was just saying that this morning, where it was reasonably feasible for people to buy houses in their late 20s and early 30s. He is of a generation where that was not the case. And they are now moving into their so-called prime. Do you know what I mean? And that's often in the cases where they haven't been able to buy their own home. And that has had a knock-on impact on forming families, putting down roots, all kinds of things. And I suppose, you know, if you look particularly the middle class vote that Fine Gael rely on, the middle classes are defined by two things. One is taking exams and the other is buying property. And if you get in the way of their buying property, you actually also get in the way of taking exams because there's so little student accommodation available now that they are. So in a sense, in terms of its core base, Fine Gael, I think, are running into problems. And Harris is in the heartland of that generation who are most affected.
Well, it's interesting to see that the polls in relation to the party support in that, because you might have hoped that there would be a bit of a bounce if you were a Fine Gael member, and there is none. Party down 1%, and Simon Harris, all freshly minted and filled with energy, on 41% popularity compared to Holly Kearns, 1% ahead of him, and Micheál Martin, 6% ahead of him.
But I think, first of all, it's probably too soon for any poll to capture the Simon Harris bits and pieces, all right? So I think that... But back to the point again. I suppose
these people would have been in the field during the week, wouldn't they?
But even until people get to know him and see what he's going to
do. People need time to get their heads around it.
They need a Galway to see the excitement that he's going to bring. But back to the list, what's really distressing, I think, for me in a political sense and a social sense is that the housing thing has been the number one issue. Even leaving health aside, I have a view on health, which is like for 90% of people in the health system, it works brilliantly and it's the best in the world. And those in the fat tail in the periphery, it's a challenge. But the housing thing, just like something that they've never really strategically said, this is the most important thing we've got to deal with and get it done.
Sorry, right? go back. I missed a bit there. Did you say that health, the only people our health system doesn't deliver for are those on the periphery?
No, I'm saying for the experience in the health system. Once you get into it, it's a really good, effective health system. For the people on the periphery who've challenged to get in or are waiting or on trolleys, but they are not the majority of the people. So the health system, from my perspective, there's lots of really good things about it and there's all those problems. But to me, the housing one is one that feels like it's fixable. It feels like if there was a proper strategic, you know, I mean, there's been all sorts of conversations about borrowing the billions that are required to make it happen. What are they doing with regard to all that legislation with regard to planning? Where is it, okay? What's the story with regard to the over-the-shop restoration? Hasn't happened. So you kind of feel at this stage they all deserve to be punished because of it.
But also, I think, John, there have been periods in our history, like the 1930s, like the 60s, and indeed the 50s, where we actually delivered housing at a range of levels for the population. We were much poorer than we are now. I think there's a couple of underlying distorting factors, the spending rules in terms of what direct bills can happen, and then the speculation of funds in the market and the distorting effect it has. And my own view is that unless we deal with that and indeed the shortage of qualified, I mean, I taught in higher ed in 2011 when an awful lot of people who'd worked in construction came out of construction and went into college. And in many cases, they were often people in their middle age and they were absolutely determined that their children would never work in construction because they had nothing when the crash came. A lot of them went to Australia, etc. And those were people where you were generations, like generations of carpenters, plumbers or electricians. There has to be a coherent strategy that actually tries to pull those people back in, but also gives them the guarantees long term. So, OK, if you're a carpenter and you get injured or if you're an electrician and you lose your job, what happens to you? There's a huge piece of work that needs to be done around that to make that space more attractive again.
Interesting, Ty, saying those finding it hard to get a house in their 30s and 40s are the generation that was hit hard by the financial crisis. The consequences are still being felt all these years later. And a text agreeing with John saying John's right about the health system from someone whose father is getting great care in a hospital. Although I assume we will also get the text of people who have had the fun experience of sitting on a chair or a trolley for a day, 2 days, 3 days, however long in A&E. Kevin Doyle, explain one thing from within this. The interesting move in terms of party popularity is that support is going to the winds. It's going to the independents, it's going to small parties. Sinn Féin, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, all down.
Yeah, it's quite disparate. It's what's actually interesting here is Fine Gael obviously won't be delighted. And I do agree with John to some extent. I think it will take a couple of weeks. You'll have to see Simon Harris versus Mary Lou in the Dáil and that kind of a setting before you get a full...
Is he not a known entity?
He is, but not in this context. So, and also, he's been very quiet for the last couple of years because he's been plotting a leadership bid. And you kind of go dark.
Very successfully.
When you're doing that, the best thing you can do is go dark for a while because he who wields the knife tends not to get the crown. And he has successfully done that. So higher education wasn't exactly a high profile portfolio that he's had. So I think it'll take a couple of weeks. I'm surprised there wasn't a bit of a bounce for Fine Gael in the sense that they have been everywhere for the last fortnight. And usually when a political party is front and centre presenting a new energy, inverted commas, trademark, they do get something of a bounce. It hasn't happened. But they won't worry hugely because Sinn Féin are also down to 26%, which means you do the maths. The votes that seem to be going from the main parties are all going to independents and others, which is meaningful and meaningless because you don't really know where that goes then. No. If you have six independents in a constituency, there might be a huge independent vote in that constituency, but it's all disparate and spread out, and therefore it doesn't coalesce around anybody, and you end up with the main party still holding their seats anyway.
So you don't think that translates into Dáil mathematics after the next election, that we see a much greater representation of smaller parties and independents in the seats?
I think we'll see a greater representation of independents. I think there will be strikeout candidates that will come true. So that little cohort where you see the Healy Rays and Matty McGrath, Carol Nolan, those, I think that part, that section of Leinster House will have to be expanded in the new Dáil when it comes. But I don't think that necessarily you're going to see Labour, Green, Sock Dems into, which I guess are the smaller parties there at the moment, having huge, big bounces, because that's not what the polls are showing. Yeah. In some ways, people say independent when they don't know.
Yeah.
And I think there is an element of this needing to decide itself.
Can I pick up on the order in which you listed them? Because in some way there is an element of bad news in that for Niamh. We would have characteristically thought of them in that order, because Labour has for the last number of years been the largest party of that group. It has been the largest party of the left until Sinn Féin stole their clothes. As we now look, Social Democrats on 6, Aintu on 4, Green Party on 4, Labour on 3%.
Yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough poll. But I suppose from my own point of view, Anton, as somebody who's running in the European elections, if you look at kind of the similar stages of the last European elections, the Greens were around that in the polls and they actually won two seats. So, you know, secondly,
but surely Labour should have more ambitions than being on a par with the Greens. We had Gilmore for Taoiseach at one point.
There's no lack of ambition in the Labour Party, but I suppose we're coming back from a low point and it'll take a long time to build it up. But I suppose one of the advantages for Labour is it is the oldest political party in the state. There is a huge network on the ground. There are a lot of councillors on the ground. There's a lot of party members still on the ground. And I suppose it'll be a matter of building back up from that base to get up to where we would like to be.
John, people giving out about you. Where does John get the idea that the health system is really good once you get into it? I'm dealing with cancer and in my experience the system is terrible. Compare it to other health services on mainland Europe and then say that it's really good. 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106 if you want to get in touch. That's a much more likely thing to do on a phone. Now, come here. There's a thing that I want to ask you, John. Facetiousness aside about the health system comment. Inside the Daily Mail, or rather the Mail on Sunday, page 4 and 5 of the Mail on Sunday, has a breakdown of what TDs will get if and when they step down. So they've said Richard Bruton doesn't stand for election. He walks away from a storied political career. He'll get a lump sum payment of €243,000 and an annual pension worth €81,000. Charlie Flanagan will leave with a pension pot worth €1.86 million and a lump sum of €200,000. Will people read that and say that is totally inappropriate that we pay politicians that way? Or will they say, if you want the best, you have to pay for it?
They're going to be a bit of both. But first of all, I think that Richard Bruton, he's 47 years as an elected representative, okay? So I think when you put it all together, it's the first time I've ever seen it like this.
42, yeah. TD for 13 years, his pension pot is €684,000.
Yeah. So I think it's the first time I've ever seen it like this. And I think Owen Murphy, they went through a good number of them there. So I think, first of all, I have huge regard for people who put themselves forward into political life, okay? And I think that it's a career that is so tenuous and so fragile that this is a way of rewarding them. I don't think the salaries in general could be seen as being kind of excessive. I know people are going to say, my God, that's outrageous. These people don't deserve it. I think the work that they do is really quite extraordinary. And if you compare it to kind of the private sector, getting a golden handshake at the end of a period is quite normal. And these are pensions that have been paid into over the 30 or 40 years. So to me, there's going to be people saying it's outrageous. They should be.
Josefa Madigan, 53, years of TD, 8, pension pot, €761,000.
Yeah, but she's 53 and she's now out of politics and she's not going to get her pension until she's 65 and she's going to have a pension that the 700 grand is going to be, what, 30 or 40 thousand a year? That's not going to kind of put her in the bracket of kind of the great rich and unwashed, I would have thought.
Would you be of the same view, Kevin, that this is due reward for the sacrifice that they make?
I think most people will look at this and use words that I can't use on the radio, if I'm honest, Anton. It is huge money. And look, the politicians, we've done this before, the rich lists and all that, and they always argue that it's not reasonable to look at this because those figures you're using are what it would be worth in the private market if I went out today and went to Mercer or one of those companies and asked them to set up a pension for me. And that's what it would be worth. So they say it's not as if they're getting 2 million into their back pocket. It's different than that. Look, it is extraordinary. Politics has, it's a tough gig. It's, I know everybody gives out, it's 108 or 9 grand now is the annual salary for a TD. I don't think I'd do it. I'd rather work in the chip shop for 25 grand than, sorry, Niamh's looking at me going, now what? But having observed it, having spent 5 years working in Leinster House in very close proximity of those people and annoying a lot of those people as we do, I genuinely, and I'll take over from John on the text message machine now getting the abuse, I don't think I'd do it for 100 grand, to be honest. You really give up so much of your life to run into politics and you're never thanked for it really in any way. All you get is told that you made a mess of it anyway and you're all the same.
And you might lose your job once every 4 years.
If you want to abuse Kevin Doyle, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087 1400 106. Coming up after the break, Paddy Cosgrave is back as the CEO of Web Summit. I have with me Kevin Doyle, who is Group Head of News for the Independent Group, Niamh Herrigan, who is Sociologist and Labour Party candidate in the European elections in Ireland South, John Cunningham, Relationship Director with Morgan McKinley, and on the phone, Charlie Taylor, who is Technology and Innovation Editor with the Business Post. And Charlie Taylor is with us because news has emerged over the weekend that Paddy Cosgrave, having resigned from the chief executiveship of the Web Summit in a bit of a storm of public controversy in relation to tweets that he had put out, is now back. Charlie, how do we know this?
Well, actually, I should stress straight away that it hasn't been confirmed. And it's quite hilarious trying to catch hold of PR people from Web Summit who have disappeared. They've gone to ground. You know, I mean, I've just written a piece up on this where usually, you know, when a CEO is announced, you know, or there's someone coming back in, it's with great fanfare. But it's the opposite in this situation, which kind of says a lot about, I suppose, how people are feeling about Cosgrave returning, if he is. You know, I mean, apparently, according to reports, I think it was in the Sindo, there it's been said that staff were told on Friday that he is returning as chief executive. Now, it should be said as well that it has been rumoured from the get-go, from when he stepped down and Catherine Marker Cover, as you may recall, in October, just before the flagship event, that she stepped in, came with great credentials, all of this, and came in to steady the ship after his resignation. There were rumours around that time that it was only a temporary thing. Lo and behold, she was in for 3 months, stepped down, and there's been an open role ever since then.
Now, since then, Charlie, because his resignation, of course, hinged on tweets in relation to Israel and Palestine and the conflict therein, and we will be talking more about that just after 11 o'clock because it is the six-month anniversary of the October 7th attacks. But it was his tweets that caused the furore that caused him to resign. Since then, as I understand it, he has remained fairly active on Twitter.
He has, yeah. I mean, after he stepped down, he went quiet for a month or two, and then he's come back in the last couple of months. And largely has been spending his time, you know, doing what he did before, which is, you know, criticizing people, attacking people, all of this stuff. And also sort of justifying himself to an extent. I mean, there were some people on Twitter who were kind of claiming there was a conspiracy against anyone speaking out on Israel Gaza, and that this is, you know, that he's kind of ended up wrapped up in the middle of this. So, I mean, that sort of, in a way, is kind of a handy justification for him to say, well, look, there was conspiracy. What I said actually wasn't that controversial, and therefore I'm in a position to stand to come back and lead the company. And I should say,
he has also been ventilating a lot of, and we need to be careful in terms of what we say in respect of this, but he's been ventilating a lot of his personal grievances with former colleagues.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, most people will probably recall there's been ongoing multiple court actions going on with co-founders of Web Summit. And yeah, as you say, we need to steer clear because very easy to step into dangerous legal territory there, you know, because there's been, you know, accusations flying left, right and center. So all of the things around his resignation have been going on while this has been happening in tandem. You know, I mean, they're not, I should stress, they're not related, but, you know, this is, you know, there's a lot of turmoil going on in the company. And my sense is that if he is returning, then that's going to cause more turmoil than there was. You know, I mean, Catherine Marr come in, has settled the waters to some extent, you know, particularly in the immediate rush after when so many companies withdrew. If you recall, there was the likes of Intel, Siemens, Amazon, all these companies pulled out of Web Summit Lisbon event. He steadied the waters a bit, but if he comes back, this is likely to cause things to be up in the air again.
Charlie, thank you very much for that. That's Charlie Taylor, who's Technology and Innovation Editor with the Business Post. That thing of settling the waters or not, John, I suppose that's the big question, which is the Web Summit has been extraordinarily successful over the last number of years, and it has had extraordinary momentum. It grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. Is it still going to be able to retain that success and momentum if it has something of a dark cloud hanging over?
One might say, who cares? Paddy Cosgrove is the 80% owner of Web Summit. It's his business. All right. So let's be very clear about this is a commercial organization. What I find really strange is if he resigned on the basis of what was seen as being inappropriate comments with regard to its impact on the business, I have no idea what's changed since then till now. So if Google and Intel and everybody else was traumatized by those comments back then, if he really is committed to his business and its success, it feels to me that coming back is potentially going to damage or may never recover. So if Catherine Martin, by the way, or Catherine Maher did a remarkable job for those 3 months where before the Lisbon summit, she got them back on track and said, I'm the new broom. I've got a different view and I'm running this business stabilised. She's
presumably
gone.
Presumably he would have taken soundings of his big clients to get a feel of what the reaction would be to his return.
I'm not too sure if Paddy would take soundings from anybody. I think he's a person who's of independent mind and thinking. And I suspect there's people around him who've told him that this is a really bad idea. And I suspect he wouldn't listen. So, I mean, the bottom line is he's coming back. It's his own business. Okay, they're not going to change the world. If the Web Summit disappeared, those other organizations have similar sorts of events. So I think we shouldn't really maybe sweat it too much or give it too much more air.
Something has changed, though, since last October when Paddy Cosgrove stepped down and apologised. Because back then, ironically enough, Paddy, who spends his whole time hating on the Irish government and the parties in it, for once was on the same side of them in his comments. And what he stood down for was over comments around Israel and their reaction to Hamas attack on October 7th. Now, at the time, the Irish government was out in a bit of a limb in what it was saying about that. And now I think, bar some who are still holding out or still unsure what to say about that, I think the dial has moved completely on that.
Well, signs on it, look at Simon Harris's comments in the speech last
week. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's the one standing ovation Simon Harris got calling for Netanyahu out in his Ordesh speech. Now, I'm pretty sure that Benjamin Netanyahu was not sitting at home watching Simon Harris on a Saturday night. Yeah. But what he actually resigned for now seems a lot less than what it was. Now, he did issue a fulsome apology and it was sincere and all the rest of it at the time. It makes his apology look like I don't want to say joke, but I mean, his apology obviously wasn't as meaningful as he said at the time. But look, he's emboldened. Paddy lives in a world where everyone's a crony. He's the type of guy I met in a pub once and he laughed and told me he wouldn't cancel me. That's how he thinks. He seems to have a higher power than the rest of us to spot decency and to spot cronyism. And his return, as reported by Niamh Horan in the Sindo, will be fascinating to watch.
Yeah. By the way, on the pensions issue, we were talking about pensions earlier on because the Mail on Sunday has a detailed breakdown of the pension pots that our TDs will earn. I won't name the politicians named in the text because I can't verify the numbers. But on the pension issue, one significant politician retired from politics, age 51, after 27 years, qualified for €130,000 plus per annum pension. Another retired 51, 15 years as a TD, qualifying for a pension of €57,000. My wife is 45 in the workplace this year. However, at 62 years of age, she can't retire. 53106 is a cost of 30 cents if you want to get in touch. 087 1400 106. Before we wrap up, you are going to increase, you're going to set a much higher bar for this program in terms of our cultural credibility, John, by referring to IMA.
Just a quick reminder to the listeners that there's an exhibition in IMA, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, up in the Royal Hospital, Kilmainham, called Self-Determination. One of the most important exhibitions we've ever put on.
And you say we because you're on the board.
I'm on the board of IMA. And it's about that time between World War I and World War II where countries in Europe were going on that path of self-determination, including Ukraine and other Eastern countries. We've actually brought together art and artefacts from that period and brought it all together. And it's open until the 21st of April, free access. So I'm encouraging all to visit.
A big thank you to Niamh Harrigan, sociologist, Labour Party candidate in the European elections in Ireland South, John Cunningham, relationship director with Morgan McKinley, and Kevin Doyle, group head of news at Media House.
The Anton Savage Show with Kiri's.ie on News Talk.